Hello, you're listening to Crossing the Desert. This podcast is a reality series about how I build my small business in the Emirates. I'm Isaac. In each episode, I share how my own business is going, but most importantly, I learn from other entrepreneurs who came to Dubai from India, Egypt, Palestine, Caribbean Islands, UK, Russia, from all over the world. Stories of their success and challenges will help me on my way. The podcast is brought to you by Fortis, the omnichannel platform that integrates POS, CRM, orders, payments, and loyalty programs for small and medium-sized businesses. Today is a special episode. I'll talk to the team who managed to build a vertical farm in the middle of the desert. We have a lot to talk about. How to find the right place and a landlord you can trust. How to renovate a huge space in just 3 months. And most importantly, how to sell a delicate and very niche product to a very demanding target audience. And to do it quickly before the flowers fade. So, meet Roman and Daria. Roman is the founder, and Daria is the vice president of growth and product. They grow greens and edible flowers on vertical farms for chiefs of high-end restaurants. If you served a mocktail in Dubai garnished with a bright flower, well, it was probably grown on their farm, Greeneration.
I am a serial entrepreneur, born and raised in Russia, moved to Dubai in 2022. Currently, founder and a group CEO of Greeneration, high-end vertical farm in Dubai. So idea initially came to my mind in 2020 when there was like a rush in this industry. Lots of companies raised funds like Aero Farms, Infarm, and many, many others. And I was looking for the new ventures, for the new business opportunities. I have some spare cash, some spare time. And I found it in vertical farming. I found a garage where I invited a team, like a typical startup, you know, to test and try to build something with our own hands, the little hydroponic station with the artificial light to see what we could grow. The first crop was basil. So that was a lot of fun. Back then, I was in a position of like active investor rather than an entrepreneur in this project. And a few months later, I realized that this thing became very interesting to me personally. I was very engaged into the development. So I decided to step in as a CEO, took over the control of the business and run it in Russia for a couple of years. Lately, I started to think, is it the right market to be? Can I build something serious in this country? Or shall I test it and implement the idea in some other places? This is how I came up with the idea to discover other markets. So I checked Europe. As you know, prices for electricity are quite high there. I checked Asia, not really my culture. And obviously, I checked Middle East. That was the moment when I realized that the market of food and beverage industry grows in the region in general quite high, but UAE specifically, the CAGR, the cumulative annual growth rate, is more than 10% for the last couple of years. And it's anticipated to reach like 15% in upcoming years. So this is a huge market where I would able to leverage the technology. Our garnish type of fancy things is not the biggest segment, but compared to other locations, let's say like Istanbul or Moscow or London, it's relatively big, maybe one of the biggest in the world, given the amount of fancy chefs that came over the last 3 to 4 years to open a restaurant, run a restaurant, run a restaurant chain or whatever. There are more than 20,000 food venues just in Dubai, and more than 1,000 of them are 100% client of us. I mean, potential client, right? We came with a very simple idea, create like farm-to-kitchen experience for the best chefs in town, offering them microgreens, edible flowers, and specialty leaves. These ingredients are quite popular in European gastro scene. But here, they are still not discovered by lots of chefs.
I remember that Roman preferred the local market to the European one, not least because of the prices for electricity, so I asked him to clarify this point a bit.
Electricity is one of the main costs in growing. It could be 30-35% of your total cost. You have to factor this from the day one. And in Dubai, there is a flat price for electricity, which is about 40 fils plus VAT plus fuel surcharge. So in results, it's less than a half of dirham in average, which is quite good, way better than in Europe, way better than, let's say, in Singapore.
Okay, a large and rapidly growing market, low electricity prices. From the outside, it looks like a good place to start.
That's why I decided to check everything with my own eyes and came for the first visit in 2022. And I immediately realized that, yes, this is definitely the right place. When I checked the Museum of Future, you know, the full floor was dedicated for the food technology and food security. And when I realized that for the government, food security is not just words, it's a real strategy. They create infrastructure, proper government bodies that could support and accelerate your lending in the region. And in general, the business environment is healthy and everybody is willing to support you. That was the moment when I realized that, yeah, we need to lend in Dubai and basically move the operations here due to the exceptional market, exceptional business environment. And, you know, I just like this place at the end of the day.
Roman had a lot of hopes for this market. All he had to do was find his place in it.
I think the biggest challenge was to find the right place. Main difficulties were related to finding the right place, right landlord, and make sure that everything what we need for the farm could be accommodated. It's not the same like you open a restaurant, right? When you need just a great location, great spot, and the rest is, you know, quite simple. You just need some water, some electricity. No, you need like a place where nearby there are no like aluminium plants or something like this, other toxic productions or whatever. You need plenty of electricity, right? Because we are producing all the product in the workshop with artificial light, lots of ACs, so you need plenty of electricity, a lot of load to make it happen. The place should be not very distant from the market, I mean main restaurant hubs. Otherwise, logistic could become a nightmare, right? So if you have a farm in Alain, you can't afford to make this everyday deliveries, sometimes even 2 or 3 deliveries per day to the restaurant because chef could forget something or bartender needs some more extra flowers. You have to be around. And ultimately, we wanted the day one work with the whole country, like on the national wide scale. That's why we wanted to choose a place somewhere between Abu Dhabi and Dubai because most of the restaurant outlets concentrated still in Dubai, but Abu Dhabi is catching up. Considering all these criteria, we looked for the plots in special zones like NAP, DIP, all DDDDD, many D. So Dubai Industrial, whatever, right? Or investment, whatever, parks, zones. And eventually we settled in Dubai Industrial City, which I think is a great zone. Lots of food businesses located there, some other farms, by the way, are smaller than ours, but still, chocolatiers and many, many others. And I think that was like a blessing because our landlord is amazing. It's a very old company, older than UAE, by the way. That was the company formed before the unification of the Emirates, right? Emirates was united in 1971. This company was formed in 67. Okay, like oil and gas. You could imagine company. For them, it was like we were like from the moon. So they were doing for the last 50 years, this oil and gas stuff, oil and gas services. And then we say, hey guys, we want to produce food in one of your workshops. And we were the first external tenant. So We basically educated them in some ways how to work with external tenants on that specific area, because this company is quite big and we are not the first tenant in their whole history, but in that area we were. And when we signed an agreement with them, I understood that everything should be fine, because before that we tested, I think, more than a few hundreds of potential plots. Yeah, we checked lots of places. Some of them we even tried to design. We started the design processes, but eventually then lease was refused by the landlord or some other obstacles. So when we decided on this place in DIC, we started to progress really fine.
Okay, so I knew that finding the right location was a big step, but why was it so important? From what Rowan just said, it sounds like finding the right landlord was the key to a successful business. I asked him why it is such a big deal, and he told me the story of an entrepreneur who had less luck with his lease.
There was a guy recently who was looking for the cottage cheese production plant, and he found like a great place potentially and almost signed a lease. For some reason, you know, like he had to go and he said he will come tomorrow. So when he came on the next day, he realized that the civil defense, these fire alarms, sprinkles that were installed yesterday, now they're gone. So I understand that maybe some people just install it as a fake to demonstrate that they are around and thought that maybe he signed the lease. I don't know. And the next day, they're gone. There are a lot of things like that. And some of landlords are just telling you, you should trust me. Let's do it. It's very hard to make a proper due diligence. It's a very important step. A lot of obstacles, right? You have to know local norms, local behavior of players. Everything is quite slow. So you have to factor all of it into the process when it comes to the finding the lease. And eventually the landlords, they are not in the competition, right? It's not a very competitive market. If you need a very specific place, there are not many lots available on the market. So you can't dictate anything. You could come up with the requests, but they have all the power to refuse all of them. So you have to build relationships. And this is something what we've done, I think, quite successfully with that company. And it took us a few months, definitely a few visits, tease all these, you know, conversations just to make sure. They also tested us because we were new in Dubai, right? Just newly formed company. It's also a high risk for the landlord, for the good one. And they want to make sure that you have like money, you really want to build something, your concept is great, you could deliver. 7 months.
After 7 months of searching for the right location and the right landlord, the new stage has begun. The renovation. And to me, it seems to be the most unpredictable. I mean, you know, even a small renovation in a personal apartment, it can become an endless process, like with an uncontrollable budget. But what can we say about the renovation of an industrial premises?
Another big challenge was finding the right constructors who could, again, accommodate our spatial fit-out requests, right? Like, I expected that it would be quite simple and quite straightforward, like it was before in Europe, in my like domestic market. But unfortunately or fortunately, that was absolutely different experience. And I had an impression that I'm building a Burj Khalifa or something like that. In terms of the process, the amount of permits we have to obtain, the stage gate processes, I don't want to say that it's overcomplicated or something. I'd rather say that this process was so developed and the permits and everything one after another. So it's very tough to shortcut. It's move faster than you want, right? So my anticipations in terms of duration of construction, right, were slightly lower than eventually we construct. Then when I understood how long would it take even to open a 60 square meter restaurant, I understood that we did a really great job with the team. We started the construction in November last year and we opened our doors in February this year. So it's less than 3.5 months for even less than 3 months until the first mass seating. So I think this is an exceptional result. the biggest problem here and what was different, again, from my expectations, project speed was slower than anticipated, but cost of running business was already here. And this is usually what the newcomers underestimate. When you come with the team, you know, you think like, bam, 2 months, we will start. Yeah, we'll start selling from the bills. We'll do everything quickly, rapidly, blah, blah, blah. That's it. And then nothing. Then in 2 months, just one guy decided to reply to you that inshallah, we will speak tomorrow, maybe, maybe not. And that was something that was killing energy of my team. And some of the team members, like the lady who was responsible for the operations, day-to-day business over the first year, she was so embarrassed with these local norms. And we even had to hire an advisor from Sheikh, real Sheikh, who gave us a few workshops to explain what's okay, what's not okay. What's not okay even in Dubai, because some of the relationships and conversations were really odd and weird. And we had to learn how to navigate in this environment if we want to do business with the companies that are well established, right? Because in some industries and in service industries, you could just do business with a like-minded people, like Indians do with Indians, Russians with Russians, Europeans, I don't know, French with French, etc. But in our niche, that wasn't possible. So we had to, from the day one, collaborate with the suitable to do the job, and that wasn't necessary Russians. All these Russians were inexperienced because they also came quite recently. So that was like two noobs are sitting in one room trying to do something that wasn't the right thing to do the business, yes? So getting back to the construction, when we find a place, we decided, okay, that now we need a constructor. What we do next? We do a tender, right? We need to find the one who could accommodate the works. For you to know that we had like a workshops absolutely empty, and we had to build the lots of structures, like lots of boxes inside the box with special requirements like water, electricity, tubes inside these growing rooms, special rooms for the germination, special rooms for the storage, seed storage, cold rooms, like food production, fully designed, aligned with the HASP requirements, like food safety requirements, ISO requirements, to meet the highest possible standards of the food production. And we expected that. First, we had specific budget in our mind, and we expected that, you know, lots of companies will compete because Dubai is clearly the real estate market, right? So constructors should be professional, responsible, rapid. They could build skyscrapers in 7 months, right? So they could do fit out in 1 month. Oh my God, that was so far away from the reality. And the first red flag was when we asked a very simple tender documents, and we even liaised with the consultants, local consultants, who knows the standards. So they said, guys, just go with these simple docs. Inshallah, everything could be fine. You will get, you know, 3 to 5 good contractors. So we submitted, asked our landlord also to share with their network. We put it in the special places for the fit-out companies. Then we started to receive like little piece of papers like that, like fit out 20 million, like this one, 5 million. I said, what's that? They said, oh, it's a bill of quantity, right? This BOQ, the way how we estimate the amount works. And so you just need to send us a 50% advance payment, and inshallah, we will complete in half of a year. I said, okay, that's crazy. What is this estimation, right? Estimate. When you do the construction in the Europe, you could receive this proposal, this estimate, you know, who is responsible for what, deadlines for everything, penalties if not delivered. Nothing was here. And eventually, 18 companies submitted something. Only 3 of them were good enough just to fulfill the documents properly. And we choose one of the suppliers from that list, considering their documents were also quite questionable in terms of accuracy and everything, in terms of our expectations mainly, right? Because for the local market, that was good. That was absolutely fine. So yeah, yalla, let's do the work. That was like a moment of uncertainty. Are we doing everything right? Plus, uncertainty was about the budget. The main thing, the figures were 4 times higher than, again, we anticipated. And I was looking into these materials, into the works. I was considering just to bring guys from Moldova, Uzbekistan, and Russia, Ukraine, relocate all of them, rent an apartment, give all of them ideas, and just complete the work with them. It would be really cheaper as a project, but permits was something that you can't manage to deliver in such model, right? Therefore, we eventually decided to go with one good contractor who was like Indian guys and with absolutely different mentality. And I said to my team, guys, you have to now start learn Indian traditions, you know, be around, be flexible, be open-minded, and basically, let's go. Let's just do it. Indians are the kings of this market in terms of, you know, banking, constructions, and many, many other industries. So if you want to be successful in Dubai, you have to learn how to make friends and partners with Indians. And yeah, there was a lot of emotions on the side, but again, credit to my team. In 3 months, we managed to do it. We almost didn't exceed the budget that was finally set with a contractor. That was also exceptional. Then, like, I chatted with lots of entrepreneurs. Some of them even didn't trust me on that. And when we completed, we did a great party on a yacht because it was a real moment to celebrate.
3 months for renovation. Wow. I mean, that's fast. Of course, I asked Roman to describe what exactly they built.
Imagine the warehouse in the middle of the industrial zone in a desert. From the outside, it's just a workshop, right? But when you come inside, you immediately feel the different air, right? Because our air is full of oxygen, because it's this is the farm in the grow boxes. Plants, when they grow, they produce oxygen. I believe this is the best place in Dubai to breathe, generally. If you're staying in Dubai during the summer, yeah, you could just put a chair on the farm and breathe, breathe, and breathe. But number-wise, this is 1,400 square meter plot where we have the area for growing of more than 1,000 square meter, because this is like a multi-layer racks. So the farm, imagine like a library shelf, and on these shelves, the plants are sitting, and like 7 to 8 layers with these plants. On each layer, you could see the lamps that giving them sunlight, imitate like Italian sunrise. For each layer, there is like a tray where the plants are located, full of water. We use like different hydroponic methods, NFT, ebb and flow, but generally speaking, imagine like a tray, whereas there are some water, it could go up, could go down, could just flow, and plants are sitting in a special medium, not in the soil, where in this medium roots are developing under this light. So we connect the irrigation system to these trays, to these shelves on these racks, and create in these rooms that we call a grow boxes, a special climate. Climate that allows plants develop in due course and produce the highest possible yields. I'll have to say that we are creating the best possible conditions, and these are like for season or bushel wraps, but for plants.
This is incredibly cool, even from an engineering point of view. You know that the task of building an oasis in the middle of the desert has been solved by many people since the 9th, 6th century BC, since the construction of the Hanging Gardens in Babylon. Since then, the engineers have experimented a lot. They brought in soil, built complex irrigation systems, tried to adapt different plants like tamarisk trees, almond trees, bougainvillea. And I like to think that Roman is just of the same kind. I mean, he built a real oasis with soft Italian sun and colorful flowers in the middle of Dubai Industrial City. Isn't that cool? But Roman does not celebrate the achievement for too long. You know why? Because he's already organizing the next steps.
Well, obviously, I was pleased and happy, but it wasn't my first completed construction project, right? So we had like five farms before. I had other construction projects, other businesses like in furniture and some other industries. So I was excited that that was done. That was done in Dubai, like a new market, like achievement, like tick box. But I was already thinking about, okay, what's next step? So now we need to do this mass seeding. We need to bring these lots of customers because we can't allow ourselves to produce very little, right? By little, put everything on stock because our shelf life is 5 to 7 days. On the planet Earth, only restaurants have a product with a lesser shelf life, the dish itself, right? With a shelf life of 5 minutes. Then we go with our flowers that could last for like 4 to 28 or 48 hours. That was like already thinking about it, and I was fully concentrated on that, how we could bring customers, how we could scale the operations, build the farm's capacity as fast as we can.
At the beginning of the episode, I said that we have two guests, and now it's time to hand the mic over to the second guest. Daria is the VP of Growth and Product, so she was the one responsible for scaling the operation. Let's ask her about it. For me, it's interesting, you know, when it comes to especially Dubai market, it's kind of saturated, overly saturated market. And I'm really curious about how do you build that B2B marketing strategy, you know, that all about quality leads, and it's not just about some expenses that could be.
That's actually a great question, because if you look at the competition in that space, so many other vertical farms have very similar and dull B2B marketing. I don't want to offend anyone, but if you look at the B2B marketing overall, you rarely see bold ideas and bold solutions, because the B2B product is more difficult to market and more difficult to sell. For us, that was a big challenge because we are in a very small niche and we work only with a handful of restaurants and hotels. We work only with Michelin star, fine dining, nice hotels, and that is a handful of people. When you think marketing and when you think, for example, paid ads, you understand that the audience is really limited. And when you bid certain money for your paid ad and it works like an auction, the price goes up and up and up depending on how many people are left in the pool. So the less people you have left to see your ad, the higher the price will be, obviously. And in our niche, we started off with very small circle of people because we only target a certain percentage of chefs and establishments in Horeca. So that was one of the challenges. And to my pride, I can say that we have nailed it, because currently the social media marketing, the content marketing that is virtually free, and then the paid ads that are run every week produce anywhere between 30 to 50 warm leads every week. And for us, that is a huge number considering how niche the market actually is.
What helped you to overcome that? I mean, was it the design behind it? What is the slogan, the tone of voice? Like, how do you think, what helps you to stand out? Because it is a very specific niche in terms of that.
Our approach is to work with many marketing channels simultaneously. So we obviously have the social media. And if you look at our Instagram, which I really encourage you to do, you'll see a lot of behind the scenes content. So we try to let people into our farm through our Instagram account and show them how everything works, like what the farm actually looks like, how the growers work inside, how the plants are growing, what are the colors, etc. And everything in the farm is quite colorful and bright, and it's eye-catching. Speaking of this marketing channel, the social media and content strategy, for us, we try to leverage the farm itself and to show people behind it as well. So to take interviews, to show faces of the growers, to make sure that our business has a face and has an identity for the market and for the client. This is when people start trusting us, especially when you work with chefs. Chefs know what they want. They are very determined. They're not the people to play around with. It's very important to build trust with them, because a chef is an artist. he or she, they create a dish. And with artists, you really need to build trust because otherwise they're very easy to choose someone else. They're not there for the price. They're not there because you have a discount. They're there because they believe in your product, they love your quality, and they have a relationship with you. That brings me to another point. In this market, in the MENA region and in GCC in general, you know that relationships play a big role. So for us, hosting live events and going to conferences, going to big events like Expo Culinaire or Gulf Food, and these are one of the biggest platforms in Dubai that bring together a lot of professionals from HoReCa and gastronomy overall, and us being there physically and meeting those chefs and giving them something to try, that also fosters a lot of the relationships. And then third, I'd say, is our brilliant sales team. We not only rely on marketing, on social media, paid ads, website, all of this, but also on the salespeople that hit the ground every single day and go physically to meet those chefs, to speak to them, to bring them the sample. And once the chef tries the sample, once the chef actually tries our microgreens or edible flowers, they are won that single second. Because in this market, we don't really have a lot of competitors in terms of the quality. Our quality is one of the best and our range is one of the biggest because you just simply cannot find some of the things we grow locally anywhere else in the UAE. You just have to import them. And we obviously, when it comes to, if you compare the imported flour or the flour grown in your backyard, meaning in our Dubai Industrial City farm.
Okay. To gain trust, they make backstage content, and they also go to gastronomic events, and literally to restaurants to let chefs try samples. And as always, behind high sales are consistent relationships with clients. So I went to discuss this with JP, marketing director of Fortis, and it turned out that they themselves are in the same position at Fortis. They make a product for demanding B2B clients, and for this, they build relationships with them. And these relationships need to be constantly maintained. They have to be kept consistent.
I'm going to give you an example of a case that we had at Fortis. We are working with this partner, and we recently had an event with this partner. And we thought about sending one big newsletter to them. And we said that we would repeat this once every month. What we ended up doing was that we decided to take that big newsletter and then divide it into four small newsletters so that we can send once a week a very small amount of information. Now, the point of this newsletter is twofold. The first is it gives us an excuse to get in touch with those partners in order to keep Fortis top of mind in their mind. That's the first thing. And then if they read the newsletter, then they get a bit of information if they want. But as long as they see in their email Fortis and then the title of the newsletter, even if they don't open it, it's a win for us because we are top of mind and they'll think about us on a regular basis. The same sort of strategy applies to Fortis, which is you don't necessarily need to have something huge to talk about in order to stay close to your customers. You just want to stay top of mind so that you sort of micro-inject awareness within the minds of your customers on a regular basis.
And as JP explained, if they Fortis needed to constantly stay in touch with the client, then the small businesses have the same task, right? So they came up with the idea of a new product that will help small businesses always stay in touch with their core audience.
So the way that this works with Fortis is within each customer, you will have in the upcoming product a date at which you last spoke to a customer. This product is not live yet, but this is what we're building. You will have alerts that will tell you, hey, you last spoke to this customer 2 or 3 weeks ago, and that's what they purchased. Maybe you could recommend that product because we see that a lot of people bundle those products together when they purchase one or the other from your store. So maybe that customer could be interested in that. You could also have notifications that say, hey, Elena, for example, has not purchased a coffee from your place in the last 3 weeks. Why don't you give her a discount and ask her to come back?
Daria told what helped them quickly gain their first client base, which approaches worked, but I'm often more interested in what didn't work. Not because I love drama, although who am I kidding, of course I do, but because mistakes often teach us faster than successes. So I asked Daria about fails.
We certainly did not have any content that backlashed or was received negatively. However, we did have some content that underperformed. And I think that is quite usual in the B2B space. Again, in the B2B space, you don't really produce a lot of viral content. You're not really positioned to reach a wide audience of millions of people because no one cares about your flowers. Come on, like people don't really eat them in their daily lives. They don't put them in the soups. They don't go to retail shop to stock on the edible flowers for the next several months. Like no one does it. And we only work again with chefs and those are a limited audience. So for us, content expectedly sometimes underperforms. That is okay. And we understand that we just need to keep trying different hypotheses and keep testing. That is why within our marketing team, we work on the hypothesis basis. So every week we ideate and we try to come up with new ideas and hypotheses to test throughout the week. And that could be different kinds of content or different kinds of interviews or incorporating something new into our reels or photos, or even in terms of PR experimentation or events, etc., etc. And that helps us to find those sweet spots and find something new that will work out. For instance, once we tried to distribute a guide on how to improve the revenue of a restaurant for chefs with a twist of using edible flowers and microgreens with certain dishes. For example, it's wide knowledge that women like aesthetic things. And when you put a flower into your mocktail, that means the mocktail will be ordered more frequently than without the flower. So based on this, you can predict that your revenue of the restaurant will grow if you use certain aesthetic flowers in the dishes. And that was the PDF that we prepared with some insights, with some research that we did. And we tried to distribute that to chefs as the first point of contact, right? To get them speak to us and to get them discuss the product. However, in our first try, when we designed the PDF, when we started trying to market it and run paid ads with it, there was zero response, like absolutely zero. No one wanted it. No one engaged with it. No one downloaded the PDF. Absolutely zero response. And we thought, oh, well, okay, that wouldn't work for us. That's not a B2B tool. That might work for B2C, but for some reason, evidently, that wouldn't work for us. And we stopped this hypothesis. We put it on pause. Then, in a couple of months, when we were going through the list of hypotheses again to ideate and to brainstorm, we stumbled upon this one and we thought, okay, let's give it a second shot. Let's try again with the same PDF. But let's try to position it a bit differently and to market it differently and maybe create another ad that will target it in a different way. And that's what we did. And the response was overwhelming. We received dozens and dozens, and I think now into hundreds of excited chefs who downloaded the PDF and who wanted to get samples from us. And we received some paying clients already from that ad. And that really taught us that the hypotheses are ever-changing and we really need to revisit them from time to time and try again. Even if something doesn't work, we don't just, you know, give it up. We try to revisit it and maybe give it another thought and that will work out.
And Roman shared a case when he managed to get a really cool, valuable and demanding client bypassing all the rules. I mean, just listen.
That's usually like a snowball. So you first show for a few very good clients what you could do, what you could deliver, what at the range. Plus, we came up with some crops that are not available with anyone else on the market that, again, make us quite special. And like with Emar, for instance, or with Emirates Flight Catering. Emar is not working with anyone who is younger than 3 years as a company in this market. And they don't care if you used to work in other markets, right? They want you to be here for at least 3 years. But given that we are proposing some very unique crops, we were entitled to shortcut this requirement and finally ship to places like Address, etc. Obviously, they care a lot about finest and highest food security standards, and we adhere to them. Like again, HASP, ISO, we passed all the audits, we passed surprise audits, and aviation, and I will give them a credit, like Emirates Flight Catering, they have the toughest audit we had in our history at the company, plus my previous experience. There was like multiple checks, surprise checks. Sometimes they just came up and said, hey, we are here. So open all the doors, they check everything. So you can't be prepared for that, right? And they do it multiple times to ensure that during these processes, you really follow what you're saying to them on the audit, right? All procedures are in place. Employees are, and growers are following all the rules, all the protocols. And eventually the end product is safe with the quality that you declare, and exact that quality would be in DXB in the first class of Emirates or business class of Emirates or on any other airlines that served by Emirates Flight Catering in DXB. And there are more than, if I'm not mistaken, more than 180 airlines like that.
I am incredibly proud with our numbers in terms of clients and our traction in the market overall. We obviously opened just this year and we opened in the end of February. Now we are in October with over 100 clients and big names like Emaar, Jumeirah, Four Seasons, a lot of Michelin star places, Burj Al Arab even. And we already supply the incredible establishments in Dubai. That means chefs trust us. So that means in under a year, we managed to win hearts of the most talented and celebrated chefs in the region and maybe even globally in the world, because obviously Dubai is this big magnet for people from all over the globe.
So as Dasha mentioned, we are on a good track with the number of outlets. I also quite excited about that because we started in March. March means almost a beginning of Ramadan. During the Ramadan, the business is quite quiet. After the Ramadan, there are holidays, then almost the end of the school year, right? And then summer. So we were bumped into the desert in the really dry season. Currently, we focus a lot on the average revenue per outlet, and we have an estimate what should be ideal during the year, but still not a lot of data to finalize it, because some people say that during the summer, the demand is decreasing 5 times, and other people saying 20 times. We observe just only 3 times, right? But we are working still at a relatively small scale. We follow the average revenue per outlet and target an amount of 4,000 dirham per outlet per month. Like average revenue per outlet is our so-called North Star metric. So it's around 50 grand per year per restaurant, just supplying with the flowers, leaves, and microgreens, right? So you could easily do the math, multiply it by 1,000 clients, and we're out of product. That's why we need more farms, at least 3 to 5 farms just in this country. And we taking aside all these new ventures with Doha, Riyadh, and other places. I would say that now we are on a track to hit a number of 700 outlets somewhere in the end of the first quarter next year. Again, thanks to our choices with the logistics suppliers, how we now deliver the orders in cooperation with the one distributing company. Plus, we receive lots of orders from abroad. And that was a bit surprising to me, but at the same time, it makes sense. Hopefully, it will make sense also to you. Let's say the great resort in the Maldives. They don't have gardens or like not a lot of gardens or place where they could grow ingredients like that. Plus, soil is not really suitable to grow lots of these things. So they have to import. And obviously, imports from Dubai should be better than from Netherlands, just you know, logistic wise, right? Like a few thousand kilometers compared a bit less. And we are considering to do these export operations at least until we build something in the Maldives, somewhere in Mali. So use this spot there to distribute to the islands nearby.
You're listening to Crossing the Desert, podcast by Fortis. Fortis helps seamlessly connect businesses and their customers and run the business. It assists in attracting and retaining customers, selling products and services, accepting payments both online and in stores, and managing finances and personnel. Join Fortis social media. Links are in the episode description. Follow our podcast or add it to your favorites. Give us 5 stars or a heart and leave us a comment. This will help other listeners find out more about us, and we'll love to read and answer them. And see you in the next episode. Production by Hatchup Podcast Studio. Showrunners and editors Alexandra Volkova and Yelena Volkova. Producer Daria Sanikova. Sound designer Ksenia Kazantseva. History consultant Alena Podnebenna. Fortis consultant JP Serhal. And I'm your host, Isaac Delonin.